jammed it back on his head, and toggled the seal. Even if Jates couldn't swim, Dave could float as long as his suit was working, and all status icons were showing green. When he got Jates gently dragged onto what was then the shore of the saltwater lake forming in the valley, he set the Verd on his back and removed his own helmet again. Wiping away tears, Dave looked over the Surgeon from head to toe. The suit liner Jates had been wearing was in tatters, and angry bruises dotted his exposed skin, yet all four limbs were sticking out in the proper direction. "Damn," Dave blinked, salty tears stinging his eyes. "How the hell did you survive that?"
"I am tough, unlike you squishy humans," the Surgeon whispered hoarsely.
"Yeah." Dave looked out at the water, and up at the ridge the wave had washed over. "You're not that tough."
"It was luck, mostly." Jates coughed up seawater again. "I don't remember most of it. Fortune favored me this day. Maybe Fortune felt bad for sticking me with a bunch of humans."
"You know what?" Dave sat back and laughed. "I'm not even offended by your wise-ass remarks."
"I do thank you for saving my life."
"Well, after getting us all into a cargo pod to save you the first time, then skydiving to save your sorry ass the second time, I
said, thank you," Jade said in a stern whisper, his voice still weak. "Do not think this means I am any less disgusted to be serving with you puny, weak creatures."
"Ah." Dave slapped a hand on the Surgeon's shoulder. "I love you too, man."
"Excuse me." Jates rolled onto his side. "I'm going to hurl."
Chapter 17. The seat and straps holding Danny and the soldier on her lap held, even when the dropship smacked down hard on its belly, bounced and skidded across wherever the hell they were. She hated not knowing what was going on. She was a captain, dammit. She outranked the platoon leader and one of the pilots, yet she had no access to the command network. Being a passenger sucked. Panels tore away from the dropship's belly, and sparks flew up through cracks in the cabin floor. The cacophony of the spacecraft scraping along whatever surface they had hit was so loud, her helmet's external speakers had cut off to protect her ears. Still, she heard a terrible, high-pitched grinding noise through her bones, transmitted through the seat. An ear-splitting bang whoosh came from forward, twin eruptions of fresh sound, and the cockpit door flexed inward. Shit. The pilots had ejected? While the dropship was on the ground? That could not... They slammed into something, and the seat groaned, then a strap broke, sending Danny and her new friend tumbling forward. When her helmet smacked the cockpit bulkhead, the nose of the ship crumpled inward, throwing her backwards. She had a sensation of flying through the air, and...
"Captain."
Someone or something was shaking her.
"Captain Grace?"
Trying to open her left eye didn't work. Something salty had the lids gummed closed, and when she tried to lift that eyebrow, her eyes stung with a burning sensation and filled with tears in an automatic reaction. Blinking the other eye assured her she could see without pain. It took a moment to focus. At first, she got a blurry image of someone wearing a motorcycle helmet. Why a helmet? Had she been in a car crash? In another blink, her eye focused and she yelped, scuttling backwards away from a horrible lizard face. It glared at her, fangs exposed, its lips working as it salivated. No. It was speaking. To her.
"Captain Grace?"
The guttural nature of the lizard voice remained even through the translation.
"Yes,"
she replied stupidly, shaking her head.
"Surgeon?"
Something in the back of her mind informed her that the two diagonal stripes on the forehead of the helmet indicated a rank of Surgeon Second Class. She could not remember the man's name. That information should be available in her visor if her eyes would focus properly.
"Where are we?"
"In some kind of warehouse," he answered.
Her mind was not able to process that immediately.
"What?"
She remembered. They had been in a dropship. It got hit by a missile or something, and... What the hell was the Dodo doing in a warehouse? turning her head, answered the question. They were in a warehouse, or some kind of light industrial factory. Materials and machinery were stacked on plastic pallets along one wall, with a crane running along the girders of the ceiling. It was impossible to determine what activity the building had been used for, because the dodo had burst through the far wall and dug a furrow in what used to be the floor, crushing and scattering whatever had once occupied the center of the structure. The dropship's tail assembly had sliced a wide gash through the ceiling, buckling it so the roof panels were sagging down haphazardly around the crumpled hull of the spacecraft. The impact had pancaked the dropship's nose past the first cabin frame, and when she saw that, she experienced an aha moment of understanding why the pilots had punched out while they were on the ground. Smoke and dust were swirling around what remained of the building's interior and pouring out the openings in the roof. Fires glowed from inside the shattered dropship, and electrical sparks flared everywhere. "The pilots?" she asked, holding up a hand for help getting up from the floor. Somehow she had gotten out of the busted ship. No, someone had gotten her out.
"They ejected,"
the Sergeant responded with a grunt as he hauled her to her feet. She wobbled, held upright more by the effect of her combat suit than her own leg muscles or sense of balance. She bit her tongue before she could say a sarcastic, "I know that." She discovered that she had already bitten her tongue for real.
"Ow! Sergeant,
The image overlaying his face resolved to Besalt, Jalteron, S2C.
"Besalt, where is Getren Zolotas?"
"Dead," the alien declared flatly. "As is the senior, Sergeant. There is only myself, Sergeant's third-class Aufex and Killari, and 26 soldiers, plus our medic."
He gestured to a Verdcris who was kneeling next to an injured soldier.
"Dead? Who is in charge here?"
"You are, Captain,"
he replied, without the disgust she expected.
"Me?"
That was perhaps not the best thing to say at that moment, nor would it be useful to remind Besalt that she was not an infantry officer.
"Oh, hell." "Sitrep," she said automatically. "Give me a status report," she added, in case the American military acronym didn't translate well into the Kristang common language.
"We're in an industrial area west of the city. The pilots ejected, and we have detected their locator beacons. We have no communications with the fleet or other units, except we have picked up a brief distress call from 3rd Platoon. Their dropship crashed near the city center. They have multiple casualties and request our assistance in covering their egress."
Danny looked around at what remained of 2nd Platoon, the unit she was attached to. Every soldier she saw had dented, scratched, or scorched armor.
"They want help from us?" she asked, unbelieving. Surely the situation should be reversed.
"We have 22 soldiers who are combat capable, plus myself and Sergeant Aufex. Killari has a broken leg, broken ribs, and a punctured lung."
24 then?
"Plus our medic," Besalt added.
Inwardly, she rolled her eyes, and her natural inner sarcasm was dying to say, "Oh, that makes it so much better." But she didn't.
"We are not supposed to be here," she said, partly to herself. "We weren't supposed to enter civilian areas of the city at all. The op-ord states that very clearly."
The entire invasion plan was based on demonstrating overwhelming force and persuading the Wargalan that fighting to keep that particular rock was not worth the cost. Urban warfare with the resulting civilian casualties would cost both sides greatly and harden the enemy's resolve. Knowing that, the Legion had designated the planet's capital city of Slugtashwan as control point Slugtown and declared it off-limits. Not only were ground troops to avoid the urban area, there was a strict no-fly zone extending 40 kilometers beyond the suburbs.
"Yet, here we are," Besalt observed coolly.
"We should be moving out of the city."
His eyes narrowed. He had heard a story about this particular human fighting a Gricka on Fesnico. That was difficult to believe.
"What are your orders, Captain?"
She stammered. "What do you advise, Sergeant?"
"I advise you to make a decision, and make it quickly."
After a beat, he added a perfunctory, "Ma'am."
Shit.
She did say that out loud and regretted it. How close are the pilots? That data was available to her somewhere. She didn't have time to eye-click through unfamiliar menus.
1.3 kilometers, he replied,
the translator making his rough estimate more precise than needed. 3/4 of a mile, her American mind converted the measurements. 3 times around a track. Okay, she made a decision. Take your squad and bring back our pilots. That seemed to please Bessalt somewhat. He lifted his chin and nodded.
What are the rules of engagement, ma'am?
The rules, yeah. Do not shoot any civilians, unless they shoot at you first. Bessalt, use minimum force, you understand? Just get our pilots back here. Wait, she held up a hand. Before you go, who is our communications expert? I need to speak with 3rd Platoon.
Show me, Ross requested, standing behind the chair of a Ruhar soldier who was analyzing sensor data. The general's dropship had landed and set out an antenna array, then flew to their current position, trailing a very long and thin spool of wire that connected to the antennas. The Ruhar were confident that it would be difficult for the enemy to locate the array, but they had also advised the general and his staff to be at least 7 kilometers away. To be safe, the dropship had landed 12 kilometers from the antennas, about as far as the spool of ultra-fine wire could stretch. Now the specialized dodo was on the ground inside the curve of a river where annual flooding created a meadow. The dropship was wrapped in a stealth field and covered with stealth netting stretched over poles, netting that generated a sophisticated hologram. Enemy sensors would see nothing other than a floodplain with a web of stream channels.
It's still preliminary, the technician warned.
It's better than nothing. Show me. Ross phrased his second instruction as an order. He did not like his time being wasted, and he did not like his staff covering their asses.
Yes, sir. We think this is the track of the last dropship that got out of the Big Mac before the forward hull hit the atmosphere.
A low-resolution image appeared on the console's display. It showed a Dodo-class dropship falling in a purely ballistic arc. That was not unusual. The landing craft were supposed to fly ballistic until they were deep in the atmosphere. This dropship, however, was not following the planned trajectory. Its projected landing zone was far to the west, closer to the ocean.
Any indication someone is alive in there?
Instead of replying, the technician fast-forwarded the video. It scrolled in a dizzying flash of images.
Watch this. Here.
The dropship dove at a steeper angle, and Ross saw why. A missile had been launched from the surface. He watched the brief air battle, fearing for the Dodo's occupants.
Freeze it, he ordered.
They bailed out?
That's what it looks like, sir. The pilots ejected, that is clear. The AI cleaned up the image as best it could.
The soldier pointed to a number in the upper left of the display, indicating that 48% of the images were based on the AI making guesses to fill in missing data.
After they bailed out, we lost them completely. The dropship crashed.
No idea where they landed?
No. But later.
The display switched to a different set of images.
There is this explosion on the ground. The AI has 73% confidence it is the self-destruct mechanism of a pilot ejection seat.
Ross grunted. That could be automatic. Doesn't mean anyone survived.
The explosion was 2 self-destruct charges at the same location. There is also what might be Legion and Wargalin weapons fire in the area.
Might be.
It's under the trees. With the broad spectrum jamming, it's the best we can do.
Anticipating the general's next question, he added, "We requested one of the sensor frigates to take a closer look at the area."
For a single dropship? Ross said with skepticism.
The Ruhar fleet was not going to retask even a small warship to look for a single platoon, especially as the fleet was still hunting for enemy SD satellites. Admiral Kuhn's people thought they had neutralized the outer ring of defenses, but they thought they had suppressed enemy defenses before the first wave landed, and that had been an embarrassing disaster. Now Ross was worried the Ruhar would obsess over finding strategic defense satellites that didn't exist. Kuhn could tie up his fleet, delay the second wave, and jeopardize the landing because he was chasing ghosts.
It's not worth risking a frigate for this. Is there anything else?
There is no indication that dropship was carrying Lieutenant Colonel Perkins, the soldier said, knowing why Ross was so interested in a single landing craft. To avoid detection and tracking, the dropships had deactivated their transponders, and the spacecraft had no external markings that were visible from a distance. Ross stiffened. He hadn't known he was being so transparent in his concern for Perkins and her team.
Good work. He slapped the back of the chair. Let me know if you get any additional data about the Dodo, but don't let it tie up your time. We've got battalions on the ground that need actionable intel.
Jesse froze when the figure in front of him held up a fist in a halt gesture.
We've got movement across the river, the figure said, identified in Jesse's visor as Metzger, Thomas, Sergeant.
Jesse was tempted to raise his rifle so he could sight through its scope, but he maintained muzzle discipline and kept the weapon pointed toward the ground in front and to his right side. He was also tempted to ask Metzger for details, but he kept silent, knowing the sergeant would report details when he had them. Besides, Jesse had a data feed from Metzger's helmet, and all it was showing was vague blotches in between the dark trees across the river. The rest of the squad was standing still, maintaining communication silence. To talk and exchange data feeds, they were using low-powered line-of-sight laser links between helmets sent in burst transmissions that hopped frequencies. If one helmet was out of Jesse's line of sight, data from that soldier would automatically be relayed from a helmet between them. It was a cool technology, allowing Jesse and the two fireteam sergeants to see everything any of their soldiers could see. In combat, the technology could be distracting, the incoming flood of data overwhelming. Jesse usually kept feeds from the two sergeants in his squad open in windows in the upper corners of his visor, seeing what they were seeing. That way, he could see only what the two experienced sergeants thought was important and ignore the clutter. Keeping chatter, including data feeds, to a minimum was important. Energy of the laser links was detectable from backscatter if the enemy were paying attention, or if the area was covered by persistent sensors. With 9 people in his squad, there could be enough laser energy bouncing around to be detectable even across the river. Jesse had to assume the enemy wasn't stupid, and not having seen sensors in the forest yet didn't mean they weren't there. Perkins had given him permission to attempt a rescue, so he had taken 2 fire teams and set out for the river at the best pace they could manage through the dense forest. Jesse had gone forward with Sergeant Metzger's fire team, while Sergeant Chan's fire team set up their artillery a 0.5 kilometer east of the river. They only had been able to carry 6 rockets, so Jesse had to be careful when calling for fire support. When they got within sight of the river, they had sent 2 scout drones ahead, crossing the quarter-mile width of the river and then splitting up to go northwest and southwest. The drone to the northwest had detected movement almost directly across the river from Jesse's position, and Metzger's team ordered the drones to return while Jesse helpfully provided effective leadership in the form of angry curses.
Damn the 2 pilots. What the hell had they been thinking?
Just before the platoon began dropping down through the tree canopy, Derek Bonsu had sent a garbled burst transmission, stating that he and Strevik would attempt to set down on the other side of the river to assess the 2 injured soldiers who landed there. The pilots had requested backup ASAP because 4 or more Wargalin were approaching their position. Then they lost contact. Now Jesse had to find, render medical assistance to, and extract across the river 4 people, not 2. In his book, that was bad initiative, bad judgment, and bad execution. 2 pilots without combat skin suits had no business playing hero. Pilots were supposed to fly, not act as cavalry. They were probably lost in the woods or being hunted by the squids, and Jesse's job had gotten much more difficult and complicated for
movement at,
Metzger started to say. Then there was no need to report anything, because they could all see what was happening with their own eyes. Derek Bonsu came stumbling out of the tree line with what Jesse guessed was Zheng on his shoulders in a fireman's carry. The trees ended by overhanging a 2-meter riverbank before the sandy shore of the river, with the bank eroded underneath whenever the river flooded and thick, tangled roots covered the bluff. Derek at first looked for a way to walk down, then quickly got down on his knees and crawled backwards, slipping in mud and loose dirt the last meter and flopping on his belly with his legs in the water. Before Jesse could try opening a laser link to the pilot's helmet, Derek rolled Zhang off his shoulder, carefully lying the Chinese soldier on the sandy shore, and scrambled back up the bank, climbing on tree roots to help two more figures as they slowly came to the riverbank. It was Rivera, who, unlike Zhang, was still in his combat skin suit. The soldier was limping badly, leaning on one shoulder of Irene Strebik. She passed Rivera off to Derek and turned, dropping to one knee and taking cover behind a particularly stout tree, unslinging her rifle and taking aim. She fired a series of three-round bursts into the woods and ducked behind the tree as return fire blew chunks out of the tree, sending dagger-like splinters flying everywhere. Derek had gotten Rivera safely down to the shore and began climbing back up, pulling his own rifle out of its holster.
"Holy shit, they did it!" Jesse gasped in amazement.
"No!" he shouted, but they didn't hear him. To communicate via laser link, the pilots had to authorize their helmets to accept the encryption handshake from the platoon network, which they apparently hadn't thought to do. Employing an alternative form of communication to get their attention, Jesse aimed above the pilots' heads and cut loose with a burst in full auto. Sensors in their helmets should identify the source of the new fire as coming from a Kristang rifle. They saw it. Irene turned, looking for Jesse, who waved his arms, hopping up and down. Irene tapped her helmet in an "I can't hear you" gesture.
"Of course you can't, dumbass," Jesse said over the squad network, forgetting he was insulting an officer.
"Down," he gesticulated. "Get down!" Pointing again, he slung his rifle and pantomimed he was swimming, jabbing a finger at the water. They got the message. Both pilots fired bursts into the trees and crawled to roll awkwardly down the riverbank, skidding and getting bumps and bruises as they bounced off protruding tree roots. Jesse was pleased to see both of them hung onto their rifles and ran over to cover the two injured soldiers.
"Sergeant Chan,"
Jesse called as he designated coordinates across the river and sent them to the artillery fire team behind him. From sensors in his helmet, he had a rough idea where the enemy rifle fire was coming from, and it appeared there was only one source of enemy fire.
"Light 'em up, two rockets."
"Affirmative," Chen responded.
"On the way."
There were only faint boom, boom sounds as one, then another rocket were spit out of their launch tubes on electromagnetic rails. The rails gave each rocket enough momentum to soar upward 50 meters before their air-breaking rockets kicked in, providing a surge of power and taking them up to 150 meters and arcing over the river. As the rockets reached the top of their arc, Jesse knew Chan had his team running away from the launch position to avoid enemy counter-battery fire. The rockets had active sensors in their nose cones, sending powerful pulses out to scan the forest beneath them. It seemed to Jesse that one of the rockets altered course slightly before the nose cones popped open, scattering submunitions to plunge down into the tree canopy. A line of fire erupted north to south in the trees across the river, and the canopy swayed.
"Set and ready," Chan reported.
His fire team had run a safe distance and had two more rocket launchers ready to fire if needed.
"Hold," Jesse ordered. "Metzger, get your drones over there."
"There's a lot of smoke and fire," the scout team sergeant reported. "That could mask the enemy from infrared scans. Recommend we send in one drone and keep one in reserve to scan for movement."
"Do what you think best," Jesse said, distracted because he was trying to ping the helmets of the pilots.
They had covered the injured soldiers with their own bodies when they saw the rockets pop up, and Bonsu was now looking back across the river while Strebik trained her rifle into the trees, anticipating trouble.
"Hello, Sergeant Coulter,"
Derek finally said, having gotten his helmet synced to the platoon network.
"Thanks for that. Zhang is in a bad way."
"I see that.
Keep your heads down until—"
"We've got calamari,"
Metzger reported, sending the drone image to Jesse. The image showed the shattered and cooked body of a Wirgalan, several limbs blown off, lying draped over a downed tree. The alien's mech suit was punctured in multiple places. Jesse checked the data feed from the drone. It was not picking up any life signs.
"Outstanding. I hope someone brought tartar sauce."
"Excuse me, but yuck,"
Metzger replied with a nervous laugh, the tension of combat wearing off.
"Major Bonsu, our strike killed one Wirgalan. How many more are there?" Jesse asked.
"None.
Relief was evident in Derek's voice. There were four of them originally.
What happened?
Well, the other three went furniture shopping, and, you know, that's never a good idea.
Furniture, sir?
Jesse grew concerned the pilot might have cracked under the strain. They were looking for a pilot seat. It didn't end well for them, if you know what I mean.
Oh,
Jesse laughed.
Yeah, good work, sir.
Hold position. We're going to verify there are no more squids on your side.
Staff Sergeant, please hurry. Zheng needs help.
We brought a medic with us. Jesse gestured for the 10th member of the squad to come forward as he watched two of Metzger's team unfold a small boat and begin inflating it.
We'll pull you out of there ASAP.
Say again, Ardva 3.
Danny wished her helmet was off so she could press a finger over her ear and drown out the ambient noise. Communications with the 3rd platoon were spotty and often drowned out by static. The comtech was doing her best, but with the dropship's transmitter offline, her ability to affect the situation was limited. Packed away somewhere in the containers in the rear of the Dodo was the platoon's transmitter, but many of the containers were shot full of holes, and it would take an hour to get the gear unpacked, inspected, and set up, if the transmitter could be made to work. She didn't have an hour.
This is Ardva 2, please repeat.
Static, followed by crackling sounds and something garbled she couldn't understand. Between the enemy jamming and the need for every word to be translated, she couldn't understand what the speaker for 3rd Platoon was saying.
Can you try?
Danny asked Sergeant Alphex. The Sergeant nodded, and Danny heard the alien woman saying something, repeating it several times. Impatiently, Danny waited, glancing over at her platoon's medic. Her platoon. It was her command now, what was left of it. A wounded soldier had died while they waited for Besalt to recover the pilots. That squad, having linked up with the pilots, was estimated to return to the ruined warehouse in 3 minutes, so she had that long to decide what to do. Pull out of the city, or go toward the center of Slugtown to attempt a rescue of 3rd Platoon. Her burden would be a hell of a lot easier if she were able to talk with someone above her in the chain of command. Someone. Anyone. Scouts she had sent out reported seeing dropships setting down outside the city to the west, where 2nd and 3rd platoons were supposed to be. The scouts also reported air battles and parachutes, with some chutes falling inside the city. Alphex looked up.
It's garbled, but I think 3rd is saying they have 15 wounded, 8 effectives. They got away from their dropship and are holed up in a sort of office building.
8?
That was worse news than she had hoped for. Much worse. If 3rd was getting out of the city, they were leaving their injured to be captured or killed, or they needed backup.
Who is in command?
A Sergeant, 3rd class, Alphex reported,
which meant Danny was still the senior officer.
Fantastic. Wonderful news. Do they have contact with anyone else?
No. A vulture overflew their position, but was chased away by enemy aircraft.
The Vulture was a 2-seat gunship spacecraft used by the Ruhar, assigned to cover the landing, but not to remain long on the surface. The force was also equipped with chicken gunship aircraft, but those had to be dropped from orbit in cargo containers or in the huge dropships that were called whales by UNEF. No whales had been assigned to the first wave. They were considered too vulnerable.
Captain Grace.
Alphex looked at her, looked down at her, for she was a foot or more taller, as were almost all of the Verdgris.
If we are pulling out, I should get the wounded. We are not pulling out, she announced, surprising herself.
When had she made that decision? The answer to that question was easy. That decision had been made for her when she volunteered to be embedded with and spy on a Verdgris infantry platoon. If a human commander committed what the Verds would consider a cowardly act, allowing 3rd Platoon to die so she could save her own skin, the damage to the Legion would be severe. She had to at least try to rescue the trapped Verds. Having announced the decision, she had to give orders. In the United States Army, an operation should be informed by a document called the Commander's Intent, explaining what they were trying to accomplish, including what would be considered success. She didn't have time to create such a document, and she wasn't entirely sure what she intended.
Alphex, we need transport. Find two vehicles to carry the wounded out of the city. The pilots can drive them. Select, four soldiers to go with them. And we need trucks or buses or something for the rest of us.
Just like that, she had committed an understrength alien platoon to a rescue mission inside a restricted area with absolutely zero intel on the number, type, and disposition of enemy forces in the area. She took comfort in the fact that, since the Ruhar 7th Fleet had missed the existence of an entire strategic defense network and ordered the assault ships to jump in, hers could not possibly be the worst decision that day.
Chapter 18.
This feels weird, Derek whispered to Irene as they were fitted for skin suits. One of the cargo containers that had made it intact to the surface was recovered by the platoon, and happily it contained 11 skin suits, still in boxes. Two of them fit the pilots, and Perkins had declared the platoon could move more quickly if the pilots were in mech suits, so that was the end of the discussion. The argument, if it could be called that, began when Irene and Derek volunteered to stay with the wounded and a medic, while the platoon moved out to, well, do whatever they could do in the middle of the gosh darned wilderness. The platoon was isolated from the rest of the Legion, without any way to effectively communicate with other units on the ground, or whoever was left in orbit. That someone was in orbit was clear from occasional flashes of light high above, though it was not known if the ships upstairs were Ruhar, were Galen, or a mixture of both. Shortly before Jesse led his squad back to the platoon, they had seen a streak in the sky, followed by a flash of light to the northeast. A ship had conducted an orbital strike against a target on the ground. A Ruhar ship hitting the enemy, or the Wargalin hitting Legion forces. They simply didn't have any way to know. Sensors in their helmets that could reliably discriminate between fire from Legion and Wargalin rifles were useless for telling what type of starships were shooting over their heads. While several cargo containers had survived the trip to the surface intact, none of them contained the heavy-duty jamming-resistant communications gear they were supposed to have.
It's not weird,
Irene whispered back as she wriggled her shoulders to get the suit settled properly around her.
It feels like a flight suit. Anyway, we have trained to use combat suits.
Sure. Twice, Derek retorted. The second time was just for fun. As a reply, Irene fastened her helmet, pulled the faceplate down, and crouched. With a spring, she leapt into the air, doing a backflip and landing perfectly, something she could never have done on her own.
Ta-da!
She announced with a bow.
Show off?
Derek had to grin.
All right, but this time we stay behind the Bang Bang people, he pantomimed firing a rifle. Okay?
You squared away, sir? Ma'am?
Jesse Coulter asked as he inspected Derek's suit.
Fine, Staff Sergeant.
Derek demonstrated by standing on one foot and leaning forward farther than he could have without the suit stabilizing his stance.
When do we move out?
Jesse looked at something in his visor.
5 minutes.
Derek lowered his voice.
You realize this could be a fool's errand. Odds are against us finding something to fly.
If we find the keys, Jesse asked with a wink.
Can you fly it?
Derek snorted.
If we can get it started, we can get it in the air.
You realize that attacking an airbase with ground troops could go wrong in a hurry. The enemy can shoot back.
We got that taken care of, Jesse boasted with false bravado, pointing to a fire team equipped with Zinger portable air defense missiles.
The truth was, he wasn't confident the platoon could successfully assault the target airbase, and if they did, there was no guarantee they would capture any flight-worthy aircraft. They did have to try, or settle for sitting out the battle for Squid World. The opportunity presented itself when a soldier reviewing sensor data collected during their plunge through the atmosphere found something unexpected, a clearing that appeared to be a small airbase for vertical takeoff craft. It was nothing more than an area of trees that had been hacked down and cleared of stumps and a scattering of temporary structures. The noses of two aircraft could be seen poking out of netting, and when Irene and Derek examined the images, they agreed the items on the ground in front of both aircraft were engine components. It was the platoon's hope they could capture the airbase without destroying either of the aircraft, that somehow they could get one of them flying, and that the pilots could get them in the air. Failing that, Colonel Perkins just hoped the base had some sort of comm gear more powerful than skin suits were equipped with. Derek privately thought finding a way to modify Wargalan communications equipment so they could talk to Legion equipment was even less likely than finding a flight-worthy aircraft. But one of the soldiers who was the platoon's comm specialist expressed confidence she could handle the task, so that was that.
"I hope you can handle air threats," Derek said doubtfully.
In the air, man-pad missiles were frightening. On the ground, the dinky little weapons looked like they would have trouble shooting down a pigeon. Jesse stiffened. He liked the pilots, and they seemed to like him. The Mavericks had always gotten along well, despite originally being thrown together by a mysterious benefactor on Paradise. That didn't mean the pilots could disparage the ground pounder's ability to do their jobs.
"We'll get you there," he said evenly, saving his anger for the enemy. "You figure out how to fly whatever we find."
With that, he turned away to check on other people.
"Derek, honey," Irene said softly. "That was a great way to be a jackass."
"What did I say?"
"Coulter and the colonel? They want to get comms, not just because we have a job to do down here, but to find out what happened to Jared and Chaika."
"Ah, shit." Derek closed his eyes tightly. "My bad. Hell, I want to know if they're okay, too. And Nert. I love that fuzzy little guy."
"Nert is not little," she reminded him, while adjusting the sling of his rifle.
Sniffling, she wiped away a tear.
"I even miss that Sergeant Jates."
"Me too." "Hey, there's no reason to miss them yet. We don't know anything."
"We do know that Dodo was behind ours in the launch sequence. You saw the ship after we launched. It was cracked in half. We didn't see any other dropships launch from the Big Mac after us."
"We didn't see much of anything," he reminded her. "There was a whole lot of kinetic shit flying around up there."
"Okay, I guess that's our cue," he added when Coulter waved to the pilots.
"If there's any shooting, we stay behind the people who know what they're doing." Irene slung her rifle.
"I won't argue with that."
"Comms are still jammed," Dave announced with disgust. He had been trying intermittently to send a signal to the fleet above, hoping someone up there would pick up his ID code and send a SAR bird down for them. Either his signal wasn't getting through, or all the search and rescue aircraft were busy on more important taskings. He couldn't use the suit's comm system for more than occasional burst transmissions, or he would risk the enemy triangulating their position.
"Okay, time for Plan B."
He bent down to gather sticks and dried brush, then used a tiny torch to set them burning.
"You intend to make a fire?"
Jates was surprised.
"That could draw the enemy's attention."
"Way out here, and the ass end of nowhere? I don't think anyone is looking this way. Not with all that."
He pointed to twisting contrails in the air high to the east and continued flashes of light in orbit.
"Going on.
The squids aren't wasting ordnance on the two of us." Jates considered that, then nodded.
"Agreed. What good will a fire do for us?"
To answer, Dave pulled a thin sheet out of his pack. It was paper thin, but could keep him warm in sub-freezing temperatures and weighed next to nothing.
"When the fire gets going, we'll throw in these wet leaves."
He pointed to the pile of leaves at his feet.
"They will make a lot of smoke."
Jate scowled.
"Survival training in hostile terrain tells us to avoid making fires and assure they burn cleanly if we must use a fire."
"Yeah, well, I took that same training course. We're going to use the smoke."
He covered the burgeoning fire with a sheet and pulled it away to release a puff of dark smoke.
"To send signals."
"Do you know Morse code?"
Jates shook his head.
"No, but I have heard of it. A primitive digital communication scheme."
"Digital?" Dave asked, surprised.
"Yes."
The Verd cocked his head. "Instead of ones and zeros, Morse uses short and long pulses, no?"
"Huh. Digital. I never thought of it that way."
"Okay, yeah."
Jates reached beside him to gather a handful of dried twigs.
You are hoping these Morse signals will be seen from space? I do not think the Ruhar will recognize your Morse system.
Dave shook his head and blew on the fire. It glowed brightly orange.
The message isn't for the hamsters. I want Shauna to see it.
Sergeant Jarrett?
Yep. She and Nert came down somewhere around here. We need to link up, or...
He looked around at the uninhabited green wilderness. We could be stuck here a very long time.
In response, Jates stood and limped away to gather more wood for the fire.
If this works, it is a clever idea, Chaika,
Jates said in a choked voice, as if it were painful to speak each word.
You think we humans aren't so stupid now?
I didn't say that, Jates growled.
Yep,
Dave grinned.
He likes me.
Derek nearly stumbled into the back of the soldier in front of him when Staff Sergeant Coulter abruptly stopped and held up a fist in the halt signal. Derek must have missed that meeting, or that memo, or however it was the infantry explained their secret handshakes, and he was concentrating on not tripping over bushes, logs, stones, vines, ground cover, and everything else that made trying to run in the forest a difficult task. Mostly, Derek had been looking at the ground 3 feet in front of himself, trying not to stumble. The soldiers appeared to have an easier time with the slow jog pace they had maintained, and not because they were more fit. The skin suits did most of the work for them. Derek wondered if, like the soldiers, he should trust the suit sensors and computer to keep him from tripping.
Why are we stopped? Coulter held up a finger for silence, with a glare back at Derek.
With their helmet faceplate sealed, no one could hear Derek talking, but he had forgotten to turn off the transmitter. A text message came in from Sergeant Metzger on the platoon-wide channel. I hear something, the message read. Derek stilled his breathing and bumped up the augmented hearing of the helmet. He heard something also. A whine, increasing in both intensity and pitch. He recognized that sound, for he knew it well. That's an aircraft taking off. He recorded the message and sent it out as text. According to the map, the airfield that was their target lay less than 3 kilometers ahead. Take cover. Minimal movement, came the order from Perkins.
Derek followed the lead of the soldier next to him, seeing Irene do the same. They huddled behind trees, keeping still in case the enemy was using movement tracking sensors. In Derek's experience, trying to track movement in a forested area from an aircraft was a waste of time. But it didn't hurt to be cautious. Hopefully, the aircraft would go wherever it was going and leave the area. It didn't. The engine sound faded, then grew louder. Through the trees, Derek tried to catch a glimpse of the aircraft. His helmet assisted and found nothing. Based on the sound, it was to the south, but he couldn't see anything at all. The aircraft must be wrapped in a stealth field, or at least engaged its chameleon wear to blend in with the sky. The threat identification system in his helmet compared the droning engine sound to its database, and an icon popped up at the bottom of his visor. It was a gunship, a type of light aircraft used by the Wargalan for close air support of ground troops. Derek saw the UNEF designation for the aircraft was W-10 Warthog, and he smiled. Someone in UNEF HQ had a sense of humor. Or history. Shit. He had hoped it was a high-performance fighter that lacked ground-scanning sensors and would soon be zooming away to challenge Legion aircraft, but it was a Warthog. Like he suspected the platoon around him were doing, he held his breath as the unseen aircraft droned on past to their south, headed away. Then the sound grew louder again, flying past to the west. Derek swiveled his head, following the invisible source of sound. So far, it had taken off to the west, turned north, and now was flying toward the east. Eye-clicking an icon in his visor provided a quick check of local weather conditions and dashed his hopes. He had thought maybe the aircraft had taken off in their direction to fly into the wind, but the wind was coming from the north. The pilot, or pilots, had flown toward the platoon for a reason other than safe takeoff procedure. When he heard the droning sound coming back, he recorded and checked a text message. They're flying a grid search, read the text. Hold position, came the reply from Perkins. There is no indication they've seen us. Do not fire. AA teams report readiness.
If the anti-aircraft missile teams reported, they did it on a separate channel, though Derek did see a pair of soldiers to his left attach a targeting box to a missile tube. The aircraft buzzed overhead to the south, closer that time. There was still no sign the platoon had been detected, but it could simply be that the aircraft's sensors were out of range. Assuming the pilot knew the footprint the aircraft's sensors could cover, the grid search would be thorough. The wild card in the equation was Derek did not know how good the Wergalan sensors were. He did know that Ruhar skin suits were difficult to detect unless you knew what to look for. He had to assume the enemy was not completely clueless. One thing he did know was the Zinger manpad missile provided by the Ruhar, officially designated Cobra by UNEV. He had trained to defend his aircraft against Cobras in case they were captured by an enemy and used against the Legion. Because in training, he had experience being shot at rather than being the shooter, he had a different perspective from the platoon's air defense soldiers. The situation was dire enough that he risked opening a channel directly to Perkins.
Colonel, we should shoot while the aircraft is coming at us. The Cobra is less effective against a crossing target.
Her response was a simple text. Acknowledged. Remaining as still as possible, Derek turned his head to watch the air defense team to his left. The soldier with the missile on her shoulder raised it, waiting for a cue from the spotter or some other signal. Seconds later, there was a barely visible puff of water vapor from the missile tube as the weapon was launched, soaring upward through the trees, already curving, though its little motor had not kicked in. When the rocket motor ignited, the missile streaked away at a speed that stunned Derek. His perspective had always been from above, and though missiles rose at high speed, his adrenaline surge made it seem like slow motion. From the ground, the missile was out of sight in the blink of an eye. The droning whine of the aircraft increased to a roar, and he heard a chattering sound. The Wergalan used slug-firing cannons rather than directed energy weapons for aircraft defense, slugs with proximity sensors that detonated the warhead in front of an incoming missile which flew into a hot wall of shrapnel. The ground shook, and trees trembled as one missile was exploded short of the target. Derek realized he was relieved, part of him wanting the aircraft to get away. Screw that, he told himself. Kill that bird before it can drop ordnance on our position. Before he understood what was happening, a soldier hauled him to his feet, tugging him to run forward. Remaining in place where missiles had been launched was not good for the platoon's health and welfare. They scattered in a well-practiced maneuver. Derek gamely followed the soldier who guided him forward, and he had taken only two jittery strides when a larger explosion from above rocked the forest and he instinctively flattened himself on the ground, grateful to see everyone else doing the same. Pieces of blackened shrapnel rained down, shredding the upper foliage of the trees, none of it doing any damage to the armor-clad platoon. Derek was about to get up when something pinged off his back, and he felt the soldier next to him push him down.
"Wait for the all clear, sir," the soldier said, and she gave him a reassuring smile.
The all-clear signal came moments later, and soldiers sprang to their feet and shed their backpacks, some of them removing spare magazines to attach to the belts of their mech suits. Derek saw one of the anti-air teams pull the targeting box off a missile launch tube and discard the tube, attaching the box to another tube as they moved. As a unit, the platoon began moving forward again at a faster pace.
"Not you, sir. Ma'am,"
the soldier next to Derek said, holding up a hand to stop them.
"Colonel says you are to hang back with me until the airfield is secured."
"Listen," Derek checked his visor for the soldier's ID. She was British, identified as Carson, Elizabeth, Corporal.
"Corporal, we don't need babysitters."
"The Colonel thinks you do need someone to keep you safe out here, so it doesn't matter what the three of us think, does it?"
She inspected the rocket launcher under the barrel of her rifle.
"I see your point," Derek conceded.
"Can we at least get closer to the airbase?" Irene argued.
"Ma'am."
Carson watched the platoon advancing through the forest at high speed. For the assault, they had left behind their backpacks and all the heavy gear, gambling that speed would win the day. The rockets that composed the platoon's light artillery had been left behind, and Derek could understand why. They couldn't risk damaging the aircraft they hoped to capture. Whatever plan Perkins had intended to implement had gone out the window when they shot down the Warthog and lost all possibility of surprise.
If the two of you get killed out here, this attack will have been for nothing.
Plus, you know, it would kind of ruin our day, Derek joked.
Carson didn't see the humor.
All right.
Irene raised her hands.
Corporal, you know how to use this artillery?
The colonel cocked her head, curious.
We've all been cross-trained, ma'am. We're not using artillery in this fight.
We're not using it now, Irene insisted. If the platoon runs into heavy opposition and has to retreat, it would help if we dropped a couple of these. She pointed to a pair of rockets propped up against a tree. On the enemy, right?
That suggestion met with Carson's approval.
Yes.
She slung her rifle.
Pick up those tubes and set them on the ground like...
The artillery wasn't needed. Unfortunately, neither were the pilots. When the call came to approach the airfield after the sounds of combat ceased, the tone of the message was not hopeful. Stepping out of the woods into the rough clearing, Irene saw with dismay that the one remaining aircraft was another two-seat Warthog gunship. She would not be transporting the platoon in that little craft, even if it were flight-worthy. Which it was not.
Shit, she exclaimed. You were not supposed to shoot up the...
Honey? Derek caught her arm, drawing her attention to a Legion soldier lying on the ground, one arm missing below the elbow. Two other human soldiers were being treated for wounds where enemy weapons had penetrated their armor, and several others were applying patches to their damaged skin suits. Irene felt absolutely like shit. The platoon had risked their lives to capture an aircraft for her to fly, and the fact that the op had failed to achieve its objective did not lessen the courage and sacrifice of the soldiers involved.
Sorry.
She took a deep breath.
How bad is it?
Jesse Coulter answered as he walked toward them, brushing soot from the front of his suit.
We're hoping you can tell us, ma'am, he said. The squid shot up their own aircraft when they saw they were losing the fight.
Following Jesse, the two pilots walked over to the temporary hangar where the Warthog was parked. The structure was just a series of hoops with fabric stretched between them, keeping direct sunlight and rain off the aircraft.
Oh,
Derek groaned when he stepped under the sagging, bullet-riddled fabric and saw the bullets had treated the Warthog roughly.
That's not good.
Can we fix it?
Jesse asked, because he felt he needed to make the effort. Derek peered inside the duct where the turbine engine sucked in air.
If we had all the duct tape in the galaxy, we couldn't put this thing together again.
Whew,
Irene agreed.
What a mess. The squids knew exactly how to disable this aircraft. Oh, hell.
She turned to step outside.
Maybe there's a spare turbine under one of these tarps.
There were a half dozen tarps clustered together on one side of the clearing, plus two more temporary hangars. One of the hoop structures was open and clearly empty. The other only had one hoop holding it up, with fabric sagging down around a lumpy shape underneath. From the clumps of leaves on low parts of the fabric and water pooled in the creases, she guessed the dirty fabric had not been disturbed in a while.
We haven't found anything like that,
Jesse reported, watching soldiers on the other side of the clearing pulling up tarps and looking underneath.
No. There are supplies and spare parts, but nothing like an engine.
We'll keep looking, he added. The squids have tents back in the woods. We haven't checked all those yet. Derek shared a discouraged look with Irene. Now that he was in the clearing, he saw that it had been blasted out of the forest with a large bomb that knocked trees down out from the center. He recalled reading that the U.S. Army had tried something similar in Vietnam, creating instant helicopter landing zones in the jungle by dropping bunker busters. The Wargalan had improved the site by dragging trees away, clearing stumps and smoothing the ground. The bomb hadn't done all the work for them. He was sure that if the enemy had airlifted in heavy equipment like a spare turbine, they would not have wasted the effort to drag it into the woods.
What's under that big tarp?
Jesse waved for them to follow.
You kinda need to see it for yourself, sir.
Derek's shoulders slumped when he pushed aside the sagging fabric. It was big. It was ungainly. It was dirty and dented and looked old.
You have got to be kidding me.
What an absolute piece of crap.
Irene's reaction was the opposite.
Cool.
She walked forward, running a gloved hand under the ugly nose of the awkward beast.
Cool.
He couldn't believe the other pilot's reaction. You realize this thing is a freaking helicopter, right?
Yeah. So?
She ignored him, walking deeper into the tent, pushing the sagging material up and out of her way.
So?
He craned his neck to see the rear of the ungainly aircraft.
This thing has an actual tail rotor. Isn't that kind of old school even back on Earth?
I guess this explains how the squids airlifted in all their supplies.
Ha!
He laughed.
What?
I love you. That made her stop her examination of the alien machine and turn around.
What prompted that?
She asked, curious.
Only you.
He shook his head, a twinkle in his eyes. Would think the idea of flying this rust bucket is cool. I am a lucky man.
Oh,
she blushed.
Is this like how, when I've been helping tear apart a gearbox and I've got grease in my hair, you tell me I'm beautiful?
Derek stuck to the safe answer.
Maybe. Why don't you ever tell me I'm beautiful after I've spent an hour working on my hair?
There is no way I am ever answering that question.
Smart man.
She patted his cheek and leaned in to kiss him. Seriously, he frowned, looking at the grimy windows on the beast. They looked like actual windows, some sort of clear composite. You think you can fly this thing?
Uh-huh.
She went up on her toes to look inside the cockpit.
I was a Black Hawk driver, remember?
Didn't the grunts, he flashed an apology to the nearest soldier, call that a crash hawk?
The Army fixed the horizontal stabilizer issue a long time ago.
She defended the aircraft's honor. Do you know whether the squids fixed all the problems with... He knocked on the canopy, alarmed by the clunky, hollow sound. This thing?
There's only one way to find out.
When the fabric cover was lifted off to expose the helicopter, it was Emily Perkins's turn to shrug and shake her head.
Somebody up there, she looked at the sky, really hates me today.
It's not so bad, ma'am, Irene assured their CO.
It looks like an insect, Perkins protested.
It looks like an old Sikorsky CH-54 Skycrane, Irene insisted. The ugly bug is a rugged aircraft, Colonel, Derek said. We got both turbines cranked over. They should start. Irene arched an eyebrow.
We're calling it the ugly bug?
We are now, Derek confirmed. Perkins stepped up on the insect-like landing gear and peered into the cockpit. She had to spit on the windows and wipe it with a glove to get a decent view.
I see only four seats. Where's the rest of the platoon supposed to sit?
Irene had an answer, pointing to what looked like a smooth-sided seat-tainer, partly covered with brush on the other side of the airfield. The end doors of the seat-tainer were open, with junk spilling out. On the side they could see, something had made a foot-long gash in the pod's skin, and elsewhere it was dented, scuffed, and dirty.
In there, ma'am. I'm pretty sure that's a dedicated cargo pod for the ugly bug.
Pretty sure?
We'll know once we look at the top of the pod. If it has brackets to attach under there,
she pointed up to the spine of the helicopter,
then it was made to fit.
How are we going to breathe in there? Derek answered that question. We could leave the back doors open or detach them. Or, you know, it looks like that thing isn't exactly airtight anyway. The look Perkins gave him did not express overwhelming confidence. Sorry, Derek added. If it makes you feel any better, I won't be flying the ugly bug.
That does not make me feel better, Perkins clarified.
All right, Strebik. You can really fly this thing?
It's a helicopter, she nodded. The flight controls mostly look familiar.
Perkins walked over to touch one of the five rotor blades that were drooping within a meter of the ground.
What about, she mentioned one of the few facts she knew about helicopters. Mast bumping.
Irene was impressed the colonel knew even that much.
It's mast bump, ma'am. It only happens once.
Because then you're dead? Irene nodded.
That isn't an issue with multi-blade designs like this. Don't worry.
The rotor blades will clear the tail boom, she declared with confidence she didn't feel. We can at least try it.
Perkins considered a moment, but only for a moment. Her choices were to attempt flying the ugly helicopter or remain at the isolated airbase and sit out the fight. Letting someone else do the fighting was not an option.
All right, Strebik, give it a shot.
Yes, ma'am. Irene's expression brightened.
While we are getting it started, could you assign a team to clear out that cargo pod and move it to the center of the airfield? I need a lot of clearance to set down on top to attach it.
Move it? Perkins was skeptical.
It has wheels.
Derek pointed to parallel tracks dug into the clearing, leading to where the pod was parked.
They must retract.
Perkins looked at the wheel tracks. They were deep, the tracks filled with water. A flattened area between the tracks made it clear the pod's bottom had been dragged in the dirt.
This day just keeps getting better and better.
As they hiked through the forest, Shauna noticed Nert regularly halting to peer intently at the sky ahead of them. His pausing to search the sky didn't slow them down. They could only walk at the speed Chowdhury could manage. The woman's skin suit was working to repair itself, using the spare tube of nanites that Shauna had brought in the container tethered to her own parachute. Nert had brought Chowdhury down as safely as he could, given the weight of two people and their gear on one parachute. The landing sent them crashing down through thick tree cover, and both Ruhar and human had sustained bumps and bruises. The serious issue was the damage to Chowdhury's thigh. They had removed her suit leg and treated the wound as best they could with the medical kit available. Chowdhury still had fragments of composite embedded in her thigh muscle, and she gritted her teeth with every power-assisted stride despite the nerve blockers administered by her suit. As the suit repaired itself, it took over more of the burden of walking from the user. Shauna still worried that Chowdhury's face was pale and her blood pressure low. She also worried that they hadn't heard from Dave or Jates, or in fact, they had not heard from anyone. Enemy jamming was strong, and the Legion must be jamming right back, for a search across the spectrum had not detected any coherent signals. Shauna glanced behind her to where Chowdhury was bravely hobbling along, grimacing whenever she had to lift her injured leg to step over a fallen log. Shauna flashed an encouraging smile and looked behind the other woman to where Nert was standing still, staring at the sky. Finally, Shauna couldn't contain her curiosity.
Nert?
Cadet Dandurf, she added when the teenager didn't respond.
What is so interesting?
Nert held up an index finger as he shrugged off his pack.
I need to check something, he explained. Be right back.
Like a squirrel, he climbed a tree, the trunk swaying and bending under his weight. Shauna's heart was in her mouth as she feared the tree would snap, but Nert stopped before he climbed so high that the tree broke. He stayed there a minute, then slid down, hopping away from the tree to thud to the ground.
It is Mr. Chaika, he reported excitedly.
What is? Shauna demanded, bewildered.
How do you know it is Dave?
Nert's grin was ear to ear.
Who else in this area would be sending smoke signals in human Morse code?
The reunion was sudden and unexpected. Shauna was in the lead, walking slowly enough so Chowdhury would not struggle too much to keep up, with Nert just behind the injured woman. Shauna splashed across a shallow stream and climbed the far bank, stepping on a downed tree. Standing right there was David Chaika, with Sergeant Jates beside him, leaning on a makeshift crutch.
Dave!
Shauna whooped with joy.
Shauna!
Dave grinned as they embraced, slapping each other on the back.
You got our message, huh?
Nert did, Shauna admitted. I saw the smoke but thought it was burning debris from orbit.
She twirled a finger over her head, encompassing numerous small fires that indeed were burning at all points of the compass.
Greetings, Mr. Chaika,
Nert waved with enthusiasm.
It was not me, really. I had tasked my suit to look for patterns underlying the jamming. Instead, it detected a pattern in your smoke signals.
Jates was skeptical.
Ruhar suit computers are programmed to recognize obscure human codes?
No, Sergeant.
Nert blushed, the already pinkish skin under his downy fur turning a deeper hue.
I had downloaded that information to my suit?
Shit, Dave cursed. I should have thought of doing that. I had to scrape the code up from memory.
Nert cocked his head.
Oh, SOS is easy. 3 dots, 3 dashes, and 3 dots.
Yeah, well, Dave hung his head sheepishly.
We practiced using that signal when I was in the Boy Scouts. It was kind of burned into my brain, you know.
Shauna shook her head.
Good thing it was. What happened to you guys?
Oh, you know, Dave shrugged. The usual.
Shauna nodded knowingly.
That bad, huh?
We landed in the water and I had to drag Fatass here. Dave jerked a thumb at Jates.
Hey, the Verd barked.
To shore. Then the freaking ship tried to kill us. Twice.
3 times, Jates corrected.
3?
Jates ticked off the incidents on his finger.
Sonic boom caused a landslide, then the impact shockwave, then the tsunami.
3, yeah, Dave agreed, his head bobbing up and down.
How about you guys?
You okay there, Chowdhury?
Hurts, she grunted. I'll live. Unless we all die down here.
Shauna looked at Jates, who was wearing only scraps of his suit liner, with palm leaves tied around his feet as sandals. The Surgeon had lost his skin suit and pack, but still wore a tool belt with a rifle slung over one shoulder.
Good news is I landed with an extra skin suit plus 1 bag of other supplies. We left the gear at our landing site about 12 clicks back.
Great, Dave's expression brightened. We need to get Tarzoon of the jungle here, he indicated Jates again, out of his string bikini and into something that covers his scaly ass.
I am not wearing a bikini,
Jates protested with a growl, looking down at his tattered suit liner. He had used a sheet from Dave's pack to wrap around his hips so the tool belt didn't chafe his already bruised skin, and another strip of sheet around his chest where the rifle sling rested.
Ah, Dave giggled.
You kinda are.
Shauna laughed.
Back home, we would call that outfit Daisy Dukes in a tube top.
She snickered, sending herself and Dave into uncontrollable gales of laughter. Jates was miserable.
If you will excuse me for a moment, he patted his tool belt, I will pull the pin and attempt to swallow one of these grenades.
Master Assassin Baltazar's Revo wiped his knife clean and sheathed it, having used the blade against the leader of his section. The other 6 members of the section had been killed by the well-prepared Wergalan defenders after being ordered to make a frontal assault that was foolish, wasteful, and just simply unprofessional. Revo killed the section leader partly because the man was an idiot, having urged Revo to come with him on one last glorious and suicidal charge against the enemy, but mostly because Revo did not have time for any nonsense like ground combat. He was on Stiglord for one purpose, and now that he was on the ground, he no longer had to pretend to be an ordinary Achakai soldier. There was at least one other master assassin on the planet from a rival house. They both had the same target. For the honor of his house, for the honor of the Achakai people. Revo had to get to Emily Perkins first. Chapter 19. As the ugly bug wobbled across the sky, the big rotor blades threatening to shake the craft apart, Irene had to admit she was wrong.
This thing is a piece of shit.
It's old, Derek reminded her.
It's not just old.
She once again applied pressure to the right with her right foot to swing the nose back onto the flight path. Instead of having 2 pedals for the tail rotor to control yaw movement left or right, there was a wheel set into the floor. Rolling the wheel to the right caused the nose to point in that direction. Rolling the wheel to the left had the opposite reaction. It made sense and freed her left foot to control the cyclic. The pitch of the rotor blade and the auto throttle was tied to the cyclic. She could also manually control the throttle, the point being that only one of her hands was used for flight controls. That was the sum of the good news. With the helicopter having been designed for Wergalan, the seat didn't fit her, so she had to straddle it, with the backrest too far behind. The foot controls were designed for the short leg tentacles of squids, forcing her into an awkward position with her legs up in the front of her. She could handle being uncomfortable if the aircraft flew properly, but it didn't.
Control in all three flight axes was intermittent, with a dangerous time lag between control input and response. She could trim the pitch, and once the aircraft got to cruise speed, the roll was dampened. But the trim for yaw wasn't working. Neither was the autopilot. The result was that the nose wobbled from right to left constantly. In any type of flying, it was important to stay ahead of the aircraft, to anticipate what the pilot needed to do next. She had to stay ahead of the ugly bug by inputting opposite yaw as soon as the nose began to swing in the correct direction.
Old isn't the only problem. When this thing came off the assembly line, they should have driven it around back and crushed it.
It's not that bad, Derek countered.
I kinda like it.
Look. He pointed to round indents in the consoles in front of them.
When's the last time you saw a military helo with cup holders?
Cool, huh?
I don't think those are—
Uh-oh. Derek interrupted her.
If I'm reading this nav system correctly.
He frowned. His visor was translating the odd squiggly Wergalan script so he could read it. We have to fly over a lake.
Yeah, so?
So this is a lake, like one of the Great Lakes. It's over 70 kilometers across at the point where we'll cross the shore.
Irene didn't like the idea of being over water that long, not only because she didn't trust the ugly bug, but also because the aircraft would be totally exposed in the open. She had been hugging terrain features, following river valleys, and only popping up over ridges when she had to. Twisting contrails in the sky to the east told her the contest for control of the airspace was not over. A single obsolete cargo helicopter flying low and slow would not highlight anyone's threat scopes, and she was not concerned about being directly targeted by a high-performance aircraft. No one flying a fighter or gunship would go out of their way to attack the ugly bug. But if a combat aircraft happened to be flying overhead, she could see a pilot toggling off a missile to pad their number of kills.
Can we go around?
Nuh-uh. Derek shook his head. My suit's nav system confirms. Going around to the north will add more than an hour of flight time and take us near a mid-sized town. Going around to south adds 97 minutes to our flight time.
That's no good. She was glad that Derek was handling the navigation chores.
Give me a compromise?
Okay. Let me... There's a narrower section to the north. If we cut across there, we'll be over water for only 48 clicks. That's the best I can do.
Colonel, Irene knew the decision on a flight plan was a judgment call. We have two options, both of them bad. Over water, they were low enough that the big rotor blades were kicking up a rooster tail of spray behind their flight path. Irene increased altitude gradually, with Derek leaning up against the canopy to see behind them. She leveled off when the rotor blades were merely creating a downwash and not a streak of visible spray pointing directly to them. 12 kilometers behind them, 36 to go, until they were over the opposite shore. Either the lake typically had no boat traffic, or the invasion had caused boaters to get back to shore, because there was nothing moving on the surface in any direction. The ugly bug was still annoyingly not keeping to a straight course, no matter how strong or delicate her control inputs. To move 48 clicks forward, they guessed they were moving through the air a distance 10 or more percent greater than that. The damned thing was also loud, not that she could hear with the noise-canceling features of her helmet. She could feel the vibration, and if that were normal, she felt sorry for the squids who regularly were assigned to fly the thing. 30 kilometers behind them, only 18 to go. The previously empty lake was dotted with islands on the eastern shore, mostly small and rocky and flat, with no structures and few trees.
Once we're over land, Derek advised, we should turn to follow this river valley. He pointed to the grimy navigation display between the seats.
Got it. Irene had no opinion other than wanting to get the flight over with. Her legs were cramping from holding the awkward position.
Just tell me when.
The ugly bug slewed to the right so abruptly her feet slipped off the controls for a moment. Her heart in her mouth, she carefully restored control and let the aircraft continue along its new course, afraid of trying to coax it in any other direction.
That wasn't normal. Derek turned to stare at the pilot.
No. She swallowed hard. That felt like loss of tail rotor authority in a simulator.
You have only experienced it in a simulator?
She shot him a look.
If it happens in flight, you don't live through the experience.
The ugly bug lurched to the right again, slipping out of her control, and just as suddenly, she had yaw authority again.
Oh, shit. Find me an island. Now.
An island, right. Derek knew better than to argue.
Perkins did not. She saw the aircraft was turning away from the shore, slowing and descending.
Strebik, what's going on?
We're setting down ASAP.
Irene did not waste time by adding a colonel or ma'am.
On the shore?
Perkins rose from the seat she straddled. The shoreline was trees in both directions, with no place to land that she could see, except for where a river flowed into that lake. There were mudflats and sandbars.
No, we're landing on the closest island that has space for us.
Negative, Perkins countermanded the pilot. The shore is only 15 kilometers. Whatever the problem is, we...
My aircraft, my authority,
Irene snapped in a voice that allowed no arguments. She respected Perkins as a CO, and she also was not taking flying advice from a know-nothing passenger.
Turn to,
Derek tried to translate Wergalan math to human in his head. Oh, hell, head toward that flat island just south of the island with the two big trees, he pointed. With Perkins fuming behind her, Irene flew straight in, not daring to swing around into the wind for landing. She was barely touching the yaw wheel, and when she did, it felt squishy, like it wasn't connected properly, or the connection was slipping. That didn't make sense. If something important had broken, it should be broken, not causing an intermittent failure. The procedure for setting the ugly bug down was as ugly as the aircraft itself. Irene got the main gear to touch, then cut power and let the nose gear flop down.
Holy shit.
Her hands were shaking.
Strebik.
Perkins's tone was frosty.
I sure hope you know what the hell you're doing. We're sitting ducks out here.
I know that, is what Irene wanted to say. She kept her comments to herself. Derek popped open the door on his side. The hinges creaked and protested.
We need to check the tail rotor. Coming with me, Strebik?
He used the pilot's last name in an effort to keep everything strictly professional. She got off the seat, her leg cramps making her fall to the dirty floor of the cockpit. Derek held out a hand to help her get to the ground, a gray shelf of rock. The whole island was a mostly fat pile of rock covered with sand, with low bushes growing in cracks where sand and water collected. The ugly bug stuck out like a sore thumb, and the shore was too far away for swimming.
Sir?
Jesse hopped out the open back of the cargo pod.
What's going on?
Derek pointed to the tail boom above the pod.
We need to get up there, inspect the tail rotor. If we can find the problem, this might be a short stop.
If you can fix it, you mean?
Jesse squinted toward the shore, already calculating how many inflatable boats they had and how many round trips it would take to ferry the platoon and all their gear. The answer was a lot of trips. Derek didn't respond. He didn't need to.
Wait, he told Irene. I saw a toolbox in the cockpit.
In less than a minute, he returned with a battered toolbox. Based on the number of empty slots, half of the tools were missing, and some others were broken. All the tools had odd spiral-shaped grips, which he guessed was better for wrapping a tentacle around. Irene was already on top of the cargo pod with Jesse and another soldier. She climbed up on top of the tail boom and shimmied back to the shrouded rotor, holding onto a blade and pulling it side to side.
It's not loose.
Is it jammed?
Try spinning it, Derek suggested helpfully. Irene shot him an I already tried that look.
Oh, Derek said as an apology.
I'm coming up. Jesse and the other soldier helped Derek climb up, and he guessed which tools were needed for removing the covering over the tail boom.
Huh.
Easy, Derek said. This covering is fastened with some sort of reusable rivets. We can remove them with this tool. He waved a pistol-shaped device and removed one of his gloves to better grip the tool.
Oh my God.
Irene's face was white.
I'm gonna be sick.
She leaned over the side of the cargo pod.
Breathe, babe, breathe.
Derek rubbed her back.
What's the problem?
Perkins demanded from below.
Derek explained while Irene tried to get her hands to stop shaking. The tail rotor gets power from the turbines through a hollow shaft that runs along the center of the tail boom. It spins, he twirled a finger to demonstrate, with gearboxes at both ends. The shaft is made of two pieces, like pipes. The one forward is bigger, and the end of the rear piece fits inside it where they couple together. There's a single pin that holds them to each other. He held up a short piece of bent pin. The pin broke. It sheared off. The tail rotor lost all power. Colonel, he glared at their CO. Without the tail rotor, torque from the main rotor would have spun us around like a top, and we would have gone straight down like a rock. Okay. Perkins was aware the entire platoon was staring at her in shock. A helicopter crash was one of the greatest fears of infantry soldiers, because they were helpless to control their fates. We didn't crash. So what happened? Irene answered that question. When the pin broke, it looks like the forward shaft spun so fast around the inner shaft, the metal sleeves tack welded themselves together. But every time I had to correct our course, that changed the pitch of the tail rotor blades, and the added torque on the shaft broke the temporary welds. She looked at the trees on the eastern shore of the lake. We would never have made it to the shore. The sleeves are almost completely worn away. Perkins considered the information silently. She had learned a lesson. When a pilot proposes to do some risky hotshot thing, it is proper to question their judgment. But when a pilot is exercising an abundance of caution, passengers should keep their damned mouths shut. Very well. Strebik, you made the right call. She didn't want to dwell on the issue in front of the platoon. They could speak privately about the issue later. Can we do anything about it? I think so, Derek replied, and Irene nodded agreement. We can use a plasma torch to weld the shafts together for real. We'll have to load test it before we take off. No complications then? Perkins asked. Well, Derek wore a rueful grin. If a Wargalan maintenance crew finds the ugly bug later and see that we welded the shafts together, they are gonna be pissed. General Ross? One of the majors working intel waved for attention. Ross barely looked up, intent on studying a message he was composing for Admiral Kuhn. What is it,
Major Verini, sir, the French officer reminded his boss. You asked,
is this important? Verini spoke quickly.
You asked if we located anyone on the surface, units that haven't checked in. We might have found someone from the Big Mac.
Perkins? Ross looked up, the message forgotten.
No, not unless they walked a long way in a short time, in the wrong direction.
Then who is it? You tracked another dropship?
No dropships were anywhere in that area. Running the sensor